Good morning. Let's see, I'm going to take off for a couple of weeks. But there's a sign-up sheet for there'll be a half-day sitting. Thank you, Richard. Let me know. Do that. You can't hear me. There'll be a half-day sitting on September 18th till about 2 o'clock here, 2:30. I'm also planning to do, as we normally do, a fall, a winter practice period. It'll start probably in October, go through November, and then end with retreat, the 2.5-day retreat at St. Dorothy's. And I'll be doing a class, but I'll talk more about that later. You don't have to do the class to be on the practice period. I'll explain more of that when I get back. I think I'm going to do the class on training the mind. I lectured on that for a couple of times. You know, the principles for training the mind, 7 principles for training the mind training, by Atisha from the Tibetan tradition, and also maybe on the 4 immeasurables, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, even-mindedness, which we can't get enough of, right? Hopefully. So I'm thinking maybe it'll be, you know, a mostly kind of group discussion. We'll be practicing them during the week, talking about it, and I'll be doing some readings and a little discussion. So today I thought I'd talk a little bit about sukha and piti, joy and rapture. I kind of counterbalance a little bit, you know, what I've been talking the last couple of weeks. You know, when Zen tends to have a strong flavor of calmness. Whatever comes, let's just be with it. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha, right? Sun, rain, I'm here for it. And last week we were talking about Dao Yu. You know, Dao Yu goes and visits the sick people. He comes back and one of his disciples says, well, how many were sick? Were they sick? And you're well. And his reply was, I'm those terms don't apply to me. You know, I mean, I'm sure he did it with compassion. It wasn't like those terms don't apply to me. Meaning that it wasn't like he was well and they were sick. He was able to really join with them. He had a sense of equanimity about the process, and he saw the cycles of existence. And so he saw himself both as well and sick. And the other koan, who is the one that is not sick? Remember, who is the one that is not sick? But also that the one who is sick is the one who enables, that rises up the one who is not sick. So we talked about that. So in Zen, very much the sense of non-duality. But in Buddhism, there are these technical terms, sukha and piti, joy and rapture. And in fact, in the early texts, most of the practitioners put a great deal of credibility in practicing what we call the jhanic states. I'm not going to go into a long lecture about the jhanic states, but basically as monks begin to clarify and perfect their meditative discipline, they begin to see that there were, in fact, various stages. When we start off, our mind is very discursive. We don't really know if we can hang out with it, but the more time we spend on the cushion and in our chairs, we begin to see. And in fact, we develop the capacity, and we begin to have little openings between our thoughts and our concentration. We can see when our mind is concentrated and when our mind isn't concentrated. At least some of the time, you can see that. So they would actually had various stages. They had 8 different stages that people began to observe. And I'm sure when they worked with their teachers, the teachers would say, well, what, you know, they would try to move them from one stage to the next stage. And in fact, Zen, the word Zen, I've said many times, Zen comes from the word Chan. In China, it's called Chan. And Chan comes from the word Jhan, which means trance. So Zen actually comes from these jhanic states or meditative awareness, because the Zen school had such a strong emphasis on meditation practice. You know, there were many ways. There was a study, devotional practices as an emphasis, but Zen had a very strong emphasis in meditation practice and applying mindfulness, especially in China, as we moved to China and Japan, into everyday life, using this kind of concentrated state. But I thought I'd just read you a couple of, I'm only going to read the first three of the jhanic states. So the first jhanic state is detached from sensual objects. It means you're not just totally hooked in to sensual objects. You begin to see that there's sensual objects, your observation, and there's a process of reacting to physical objects. Detached from sensual objects, O monks, detached from unwholesome states of mind, the monk enters into the first absorption, which is accompanied by thought concentration, vitaka, and discursive thinking, and is born of detachment, and is filled with rapture, pity, piti, and joy, sukha. So you have concentration, you've gone a long way to eliminating the hindrances of aversion and greed and sloth and restfulness and doubt, that this can actually, you can cultivate your state of mind. And when the hindrances begin to subside, you experience more joy and rapture. That's the first jhanic state, or absorption, state of absorption. But you also notice that in the first one, you still have elements of discursive thinking. There's still, the mind is still active. In the second jhanic state, after subsiding, the subsiding of thought, a conception, and discursive thinking, now discursive thinking is beginning to abate even more, and by gaining inner tranquility and oneness of mind, he or she enters into a state free from thought, conception, and discursive thinking. The second absorption, which is born of concentration, more samadhi, more concentration, more samadhi, more clarity. Mind is less active, and it is filled with rapture, piti, and joy, sukha. These are the byproducts of a concentrated state. The third absorption. After the fading away of rapture, he dwells in equanimity, mindfulness, clearly conscious, and he or she experiences in his person that feeling of which the noble ones say, happy lives the man or woman of equanimity and attentive mind. Thus he enters the third absorption. So in the third absorption, actually, sukha and piti aren't so present. It's mostly just equanimity, presence with a sense of calmness. And the fourth absorption, after having given up pleasure and pain, and through the disappearance of previous joy and grief, he enters into a stage beyond pleasure and pain, into the fourth absorption, which is purified by equanimity and mindfulness. So even more equanimity and mindfulness. These are the first four. There's four more after this. So these are the four jhanic states. In Zen, especially in Soto Zen, the jhanic states aren't emphasized. And the reason why they aren't is because the mind will strive for ever high attainments. Well, I must be in the first jhanic state, and this isn't quite where it's at. I've got to get up. It's not really where it's at until you get to the third or fourth or fifth jhanic state. Well, you're in the fourth jhanic state, I'm only in the first jhanic state. So you can see where that can kind of take. You're never quite there, right? So meditators begin to see something was wrong with this process. There was a certain amount of attainment, just another way of accumulating karma. So let's see what Suzuki Roshi, how he presents practice. And actually, if you listen closely, he includes the jhanic states. The most important things in our practice are the physical posture and our way of breathing. Right here, right now, in the posture, feeling your body, your groundedness on the earth, and being in touch with your breath. This is the most important thing. We're not so concerned about a deep understanding of Buddhism. As a philosophy, Buddhism is very deep, wide, and a firm system of thought. But Zen is not concerned about philosophical understanding. We emphasize practice. Just being here with your body, being here with the breath. We should understand why our physical posture and breathing exercises are so important. Because they bring us back to the present moment. Which is what the jhanic states, practices of jhanic. There's all kinds of practices to get to the jhanic states. Right? Instead of having a deep understanding of the teaching, we need a strong confidence in our teaching, which says that originally we have Buddha nature. Our practice is based on this faith. So it's almost more of a faith practice. You sit, you pay attention, you let go of being in a special state, and you just trust the process. You trust the process of breath, paying attention, present moment, it will take you where it takes you. Now a couple paragraphs later he says, according to the traditional Buddhist understanding, our human nature is without ego. In other words, referencing back to this original state. Our original state is basically without ego. When we have no idea of ego, we have Buddha's view of life. Our egotistical ideas are delusion, covering our Buddha nature. We are always creating and following them. And repeating this process over and over again, our life becomes completely occupied by ego-centered ideas. Also known in our parlance as self-centeredness, right? This is called karmic life, or karma. The Buddhist idea should not be karmic life. The purpose of our practice is to cut off the karmic spinning mind. If you are trying to attain enlightenment, this is a part of karma. So again, if you're trying to attain these jhanic states, that can create karma. Just another way of exercising the greed-seeking mind, right? Or stimulating this. This is a part of karma. You are creating and being driven by karma, and you are wasting your time on your black cushion. According to Bodhidharma's understanding, practice based on any gaining idea is just a repetition of your karma. Forgetting this point, many later Zen masters have emphasized some stage to be attained by practice. So he's saying even in the Zen tradition, people keep forgetting this and they get into various stages like the five ranks and things like this. But just, again, emphasizing posture, breath, present moment, faith, that you will get more in touch with your unconditioned nature and from this, a natural unfolding of more joy and more happiness. So, you know, when Buddha, last night was kind of an interesting evening. I was asked to go speak at the, it's one of three kind of concluding ministers at the Congregationalist Church. It was a interfaith dialogue celebrating Ramadan, which started this week. And also the idea of bringing together the difficulties that the Muslim community is facing with the events in Hiroshima, which is also being celebrated by, not celebrated, but being reflected upon by the Japanese community. And how the idea being that both groups of people have suffered, and how to bring awareness of that situation, and through the awareness, how to bring people together. So it was actually, I thought, quite a successful meeting. Didn't you think so? Yeah. And they had a survivor of Hiroshima speak. And it was quite moving, actually. You know, in his 80s, and came to this country when he was 17, buried six members of his family, and how he said how much hatred he had, actually, even in his country, for the Americans. And for the whole, what happened, of course. Eventually, he ended up in a mental institution, which is in Japanese culture, that's there's not much tolerance for that happening. But in that, in the mental institution, there was a nurse there that reached out to him with a sense of tenderness and compassion, and it was a pivotal turning point in his life. That one healing presence of this one person, and it changed him to a place of where he now has really dedicated his life and has for a number of years to really healing through forgiveness and through open-heartedness. So that was very touching. And then there was another person that from Sonoma County who teaches origami. And if you visit, I haven't visited Hiroshima, but there's a place there where you cranes are considered in Japanese mythologies as being very kind of sacred and very healing. And so one of the young children that was affected by leukemia started to make these cranes. You've heard the story. I've not heard the story myself. Made these cranes, and now when you go there, that's one of the possibilities. You kind of create this in a way of getting in sympathy and in attunement with the suffering that went on at that time. So they had the stage was decorated with thousands of these cranes that people in the community had made. He goes around and teaches this. It's a practice. And then there was a person from the Islamic community who spoke, the local cleric, who spoke very movingly, actually, of what it was like after 9/11 to experience that kind of discrimination, you know, where the FBI, even here in Sonoma County, you know, broke into his house pretty much at night, unannounced, and really kind of shook him and his family up, and just what it's like to get on a plane, you know, or when you have to go through the line to go and get on the plane, just the amount of fear that is directed towards him and anybody that, you know, looks that way or certainly wears a veil. So I'm saying this because when I got up to speak, I actually presented the Metta. I was the last one, and I presented the Metta Sutra as a way in my introduction was twofold. One, I said that compassion, the way compassion arises is by feeling the suffering of others. So it was important for people from Hiroshima, the Japanese community, and it was important for the Islamic community to be able to articulate their suffering, to feel it and to share their suffering with others, because there's no other way. You know, other ways you can tend to only go towards, you know, trance states as a way to kind of distance yourself from the suffering of the world. So compassion is created by being able to listen to the pains, to listen to the suffering of other people. And then, of course, to balance that with a sense of equanimity that happens, that your meditation practice can, you can cultivate within yourself. It's that balancing of the two, which really creates maturity. So suffering, you know, Buddha, suffering was not about pushing away suffering, the First Noble Truth. You know, what it was about was engaging with it. Buddha taught, how do you get to the real roots of suffering? What are the real roots of suffering? What is the basis of the self-clinging, the sense of self-protection? You know, what is that about? You know, it's about really being here. The phrase I've always loved is being here for the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. It's a beautiful phrase. Being here for the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. How to really feel connected with life. Being alive is being connected with both. You know, connecting with this sense of aliveness. But it's important in our practice. Sometimes practice can tend to be a little bit on the serious side and very intense, very concentrated, very kind of serious. And so it's important to recognize these qualities of the mind which have a certain levity to them and to orient the mind to that. And some of the original teachings in Buddhism are very helpful in that regard. You know, the early Abhidharma would talk about the kushala states and unkushala states. And kushala means those states which tend to be those feelings of expansiveness and ease and openness. I mean, we could call them joy or rapture, but there are a number of states that are like that. you know, of feelings of expansion and ease and openness. And the idea is that we pay attention to those states, we welcome those states, and we actively try to cultivate those states. And we're also equally aware of what we call the akushala states, those states of mind where we tend to contract, anger, those places where we tend to push people away. And we're aware of that very subtly. Our meditation practice helps us. So the akushala states keep us from recognizing the naturalness of our mind. It wants to be oriented towards openness and expansiveness. And I've always appreciated the Dalai Lama because his orientation is so strong. Every lecture that he gives, I would say everyone that I've ever heard always says, everybody wants to be happy. So no matter how misguided their actions are, just remember behind that, don't just focus on the misguidedness of their action. Focus on the fact that everybody wants to be happy. And people are just misguided in terms of how they go about trying to cultivate that. But we all share that. That's the place that we all share, that we're all trying for this, for our family. We're all looking for a sense of wholeness and completion and ease. We're all wanting that. And we all experience that in our meditation practice and our everyday life. If we didn't experience that periodically, we'd go crazy, right? And so our practice is to acknowledge that and to really cultivate that. I was watching a documentary the other day on Dachau. It was called The Fall of the Third Reich. And it was one of those pictures that you've all seen of when they went into Dachau, you know, and all the bodies. And I usually find that I can't, you know, I can watch a certain amount of it and then I have to kind of avert my eyes. But there was one picture that was particularly striking to me. It was a young boy that was 17, and he, amidst all these bodies, he was smiling. And the quote was, "This will be like my second birthday, when I was born and the day that I was liberated." And even when in that, having lived in those kinds of conditions, he was able to touch into a place where he actually could smile. And I thought that it's there, you know, it's there. That was an example to me of how that if we can trust and have faith in that kind of accessibility. So what Buddhist practice says is that we can cultivate these states. We can't exactly call them into existence at will, but more and more we can become familiar with them, and our intention is to abide in them. And that's really important. The Dhammapada says in one of its first chapters, right intention, whatever the practitioner frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind. The important thing that Buddhism postulates is that the mind can be trained. The mind can be trained. And that when we are calm and generous and kind and we abide in gratitude, we do experience happier states of mind. And we know that. And I think the more we practice, our spiritual practice develops, the more we have faith in that. But there is kind of a countervailing reality in that there's a fellow who's going to be speaking. I don't know if he's going to be at Spirit Rock or where, called Rick Hansen. Has a book called The Buddha's Brain, The Practical Neuroscience of Happiness, Love, and Wisdom States. You know, neuroscience is kind of like the kind of cutting edge now for psychology and even Buddhism. I notice all these workshops. And what he says is really basically true. I found this to be true in my therapy practice, is that to help us survive, the brain has evolved to register negative experiences. And that's true. You know, if you have 100 positive experiences with a dog, but one dog comes up and bites you, that one negative experience is going to imprint yourself. And the reason why that was because that's how our ancestors learned how to survive, to stay away from situations that were going to terminate them, right? So he has a quote in here which is kind of interesting. You know, the amygdala of the brain is that part of the frontal lobe of the brain which particularly imprints these images. And he says negative is like Velcro and positive is like Teflon. So it means that our work is kind of cut out for us. Especially, you know, I work with people in jail that have a lot of post-traumatic stress, and Chris is working with vets that have a lot of post-traumatic stress. So these grooves are pretty deep. But they're also deep if we come from childhoods where we didn't get what we were supposed to get or there was some kind of abuse. So we have to try extra hard to actually cultivate and look out for positive and cultivate and be receptive to positive experiences. And I do believe that one of the things about meditation is if we can just feel in those places when we're not happy, this is a very important point, and don't go into the storyline, don't shut out the physical sensations of anxiety or fear, but if we can just learn to be with them in a way that a parent would be with their child. And I've said this again and again, I can't say it enough, but the brain really does begin to reprogram itself by having a calm sense and non-reactivity to those physical sensations. That is how the brain reprograms itself. So do something positive for yourself. Meditate, find the calm nature of your mind, be with yourself in a compassionate way, move, do positive things for yourself, sit with the Sangha, eliminate guilt. All these things will help us cultivate those particular pathways. And our practice is not so much oriented towards a goal. This, and this is what I need to do. Or changing the circumstance of our life. Not that those aren't important. They are important. But the thrust of our practice primarily is to train the mind. To train the mind that whenever situation we find ourselves, that we can respond to it in a more positive way. So I'll be gone for a couple weeks. So look for positive things in your life. And abide in them, acknowledge them. Sometimes, try this one practice. Often at the end of the day, somebody will say, well, how did it go? And you will often respond in what went negative. You know, somebody did something to you on the highway or the freeway, or you had a negative exchange. But at the end of the day, if you actually reflect on every exchange you've had with a person during the day, and just remember what that was like, almost every one of them is positive. People smile, make a connection with you. It happens throughout the day. And if we can acknowledge that and realize that, and it's true about ourselves, you know, we're basically good people. We're good people most of the time. And we don't acknowledge that. You know, we tend to want to hone in on those parts that we don't like about ourselves. So we need to reorient. And we can train ourselves to do that. So you're intending the mind, you're orienting the mind in this direction, and you're paying attention to those places that steer your mind in the other direction. So, you know, those of you that don't do the practice, at every night, just think of three things that you're grateful for. Three things that you're grateful for. And they can be the same things every night. But then occasionally something new will pop up. You know. Yes, Richard.
I've been reading a book by David Brooks called The Social Animal. And yeah. I bring it up because if you would like access, at least for me, to some of this underlying neuroscience, and this, he's consolidated it all in a very easily accessible way, reinforces everything that you're saying.
Yeah. Great book. I actually have lectured on that two or three times in here because every three pages in that book, I usually find something because he's such a great researcher. Mm. And I love the study. So yeah, I highly recommend that book. And also listening to it. I've mentioned that in here a number of times that he's make it a practice to listen, because I tend to be more on the left side of things, and he gets me to see things.
If there were Republican candidates who followed his philosophy, go for it.
Yeah. Any other questions do you have? Yes.
The neuroscience and the brain as